heard you down the street. Feel like I'm.
Well, happy end of 2017. You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. You're right now listening to one of my songs, Dawning on Me, that was influenced directly by my talk with Ken Stringfellow. And Ken Stringfellow, I got to do backing vocals on this. One of the highlights of my 2017 was talking about this song and about the philosophy behind this podcast in general on the Dr. Drew podcast. So if you want to hear my extended aesthetics lecture of why and how you can adjust your own sensibilities to appreciate things you were not able to appreciate before, you can go listen to it there. But if you're familiar with this podcast, you already know, in effect, what I'm talking about. It has been my pleasure for 2 years now to introduce you to songwriters you might not have been familiar with, or take a closer look at songs or songwriters that maybe already mean something to you. To celebrate the end of the year, I've gathered a few past guests who've had a release since I talked to them to do the normal Nakedly Examined Music song analysis thing on just one of their new songs. So first you're going to hear from Bradley Scott of the Bay Area band The Bye Bye Blackbirds. This year they released a new album, Take Out the Poison, and we're going to talk about the song Duet, which is a duet with Lindsay Page Garfield. He had been on Nakedly Examined Music episode 32. And we're going to move all the way back to one of my first interviews, episode 5, with Jeff Heiskell. I knew him from the 90s band Judy Bats, but he has now released a new album, Emotional Terrorism, under his current moniker, High School. We're going to talk about Still Life with Broken Heart from that album. Then we're going to return to my old friend and former bandmate, Steve Petrinko. He appeared on my episode 6. As you may remember at the time, despite his having written many creative original songs, he was just finishing up an album of all Elvis covers. And in 2017, he finished his album of all Bee Gees covers. So we're going to hear his version of Wind of Change. Finally, we're going to bring on the mixing engineer and chief editor for this podcast, Tyler Hislop. He appeared with me on Nakedly Examined Music episode 24, talking about his many rap albums. I'm going to reflect back with him on the course of the show, and we're going to hear a song he put together that I actually did a little bit of work on, providing a little vocal theme. The song is called Wounds and Nihilism, parentheses Quantum Androids. Thanks again so much for listening. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you're interested in supporting this endeavor, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. If you do that, you can actually get bonus footage from each of these conversations. Hear a few more stories about guests for this podcast that didn't quite happen, what else these folks are working on, and a little more shop talk. Hope you enjoy this thing we've put together. Here's my conversation with Bradley Scott.
Hello.
Hello, Bradley. It's Mark.
Good to hear from you.
It is very cool that you finished the album that you had announced with the first song on our last discussion. That was Let Your Hair Fall Down, covered on Nakedly Examined Music number 32 about a year ago, just around this time. We released it just after Christmas.
That's wild. Yeah, you're right.
So yeah, say something about, before we play it in full, the genesis of this. I see this is a, as well as being called duet, it actually is a duet and is co-written with Lindsay Page Garfield. Say something about that collaboration.
Lindsay was a singer-songwriter, brilliant singer-songwriter, who lived around here until recently. She lives in L.A. now. We became friends when her previous band, Or the Whale, played with us. That friendship sort of led to her sitting in with the band sometimes, singing some harmonies. She sang on the previous record, We Need the Rain. I would play guitar with her a little bit sometimes when she would do her own shows. So, you know, it was just sort of this local community partnership that we had. And when that song was kind of coming together, it was just one of those songs where I sort of felt like I'd hit not so much a wall, but I sort of felt like I had done what I could do with it and that there was something else to be done with it. And, you know, I needed some help. And so Lindsay, being a great writer, was just kind of one of the first people I thought of to come do that. And it was planned to be a duet from the beginning. Like, that was actually kind of something that I had in mind about the album in general, that there would be a few guest vocalists in the duet style. So her writing it was obviously thinking, well, she's also going to sing it. You know, she's going to be the guest singer as well. And so it was sort of just an organic process of us. We'd already been playing together and doing various projects together. So as soon as I felt like that song needed a little something different, you know, she was the first person I thought of.
Yeah, it's definitely got that old Flying Burrito Brothers with Emmylou Harris kind of thing.
Well, it's funny, the specifics, I love duets in general, and I think especially in country music and maybe soul music for some reason, like those genres just lend themselves beautifully to these kind of relationship conversation sort of songs. The song specifically that I thought of was, there's a great Rodney Crowell hit from the 80s when he and his then wife Roseanne Cash did, called It's Such a Small World, which is just an incredible duet, just really powerful, gorgeous, one of my favorite songs from that era. And so I just sort of have always carried in the back of my mind that I would love to find a way to channel a little bit of that vibe of that song. And so hopefully we did that.
All right, let's play it. I know you talked about in our last conversation how one of the songs that we covered was a ballad and how that was kind of unusual for you. This record definitely stretches out more, that you've got songs like I Meant to Write that are pretty yearning in that way. But this one, even though it's potentially, you know, has that country music, I'm without you kind of thing, it's pretty jaunty. You provided this video that I'll direct folks to go with it, that kind of helps, at least for me, interpret what you were intending with the overall mood. And so it's just people walking around, you know, a woman walking around the streets of San Francisco, more or less by herself, and then passes a guy sitting in a cafe, doesn't interact with him, but then he leaves the cafe and it follows him walking around for the rest of the time. And that's, they look kind of lonely. It's a walking song. It's a moving song. It's not a drowning in liquor song.
It's very much a city song. Like, it's, you know, there are references in the song to walking down city streets, and there's activity in the city. There's a show that's referenced, you know. So it's very much like an urban energy song, but I think you've hit on it. And through the video, I think we did a pretty good job of capturing that aspect of these isolated figures that are somehow connected, but they don't ever connect kind of thing. The video actually is a fairly accurate picture of one of the kind of feelings that I just had in mind when I was writing it, of even that specific neighborhood, which I don't remember if I wrote it in that neighborhood or not. That's the North Beach neighborhood of San Francisco. But just that feeling of, like, are they a couple that's broken up? She's carrying a suitcase. You know, is it like a ship's passing in the night kind of thing? You know, he walks basically the same route, the opposite of what she walks at the beginning of the video. You know, I just kind of wanted to create this sort of ambiguous but resonant sort of experience of this couple and what potentially their relationship might be. But you're right, it's a city song. It's got some energy to it, despite being melancholy.
Well, and you have some left turns, you know, as always in your chord progressions, more so on other songs in the album that I hear more of the obvious game theory influence jumping out. But even here, you've got the Down the Streets and Through the City, that transition that it sort of takes off a little into the air and breaks out of. I wouldn't expect that out of a Roseanne Cash related song. I'm not familiar with the one in particular you referred to, but you've got a little more theatrical in the transitions here. And also the way it ends, that it ends on this, well, the fact that you have explosions of strings, like, right? Is this the first time you'd put full strings in a song?
It is, yeah. And it was such a thrill to do that. And I think one of Mark Clifford is the guy that did the string arrangement. I think he sort of picked up on what you're talking about, the drama of some of those chord progressions that are unusual and unexpected. And he really builds off of those. You know, he really emphasizes them in a way that the rest of the song sort of doesn't. Like, it's a very strummy song. You can kind of strum through the song and not realize that anything complicated is going on. But I think he really drew attention to some of the, what you're talking about, some of the little detours, and brought some of the drama of that, you know, to the arrangement.
Well, I also like the punctuation of the complete stops, and also just the intro riff with the clapping that you've got there. Like, I noticed one of the other songs on the album, Poison Love, you know, you start out with this, almost sounds like it's an Elvis thing. And this has that iconic, you know, this, but it's a little more dorky. Like, it almost sounds like the way it's articulated, like a Devo song rather than a Elvis song or something.
Yeah, that's funny. I hadn't thought of it, but the hand claps are sort of incongruous in a way, but I just kind of couldn't live without them at the same time. Like, and I think mentioning Poison Love, I mean, I'm a total sucker for like old 50s rock and roll intros, you know, like a Duane Eddy song, or a, you know, like I said, an Elvis song, or rockabilly or something like that. So like a little twangy thing like that, or a little slide up to a chord or whatever. Like, I'm totally a sucker for that stuff, and I love it and use it maybe a little too often. But one of the things I'm proud of, I think, with Duet is that it's this funny collection of all of these strange little things, but it's not really pulling you all over the place. Like, it feels very natural to me. Like, all these elements come together and it flows, and it just feels very immediate. But like, when you kind of take it apart, you're like, well, that's strange. It's got this intro and then this string section and all these other things going on, this honky-tonk guitar solo. I mean, all these kind of things that don't seem to go together, but at least to me, they go together.
Yeah, well, and I also appreciated the fact that you could have, after I Will Sing With You, But I Can't Make the Show, you could put that same riff right there again, but no, let's just have it stop, you know, so it's a similar effect, but it doesn't quite punch you in the face in the way that putting that riff there, or a shorter version of that riff or something again, would have done.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I can entirely see someone talking me out of that, so that might have been the case.
I almost felt like I wasn't listening to this on headphones, but that the clap noise, like, I could hear echoes of it. Is that part of this layered onto the snare throughout as well? Or no, it just comes the one time?
No, it's just, I think, just okay. Two times.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the times it comes. During the breaks.
It's part of the general feel, you know, so it makes sense that you would hear sort of that kind of echo of it, that groove, and those accents are definitely something that are a piece.
Yeah, something about the timbre of the way the snare was engineered made me think that maybe that was on there, but I think it just was well engineered to blend together so that it was not incongruous to have that clapping there when it comes.
It is beautifully recorded. Proud in general of the sounds on the record, but that song is one of those ones that stands out to me. It's one where Scott Evans, the engineer, really, really was on fire, both in his engineering and his mixing. It just sounds beautiful to me.
Just to widen the discussion a little bit about, I know when you were getting into Let Your Hair Fall Down, the first song recorded for this, it was definitely a stylistic movement that you'd replace some members. I feel like the sound really opened up. If this was the only album I heard, I would have not had any inclination to call you a power pop band or anything like that. Like, you know, it's definitely quite a bit wider. And like you said, the recordings, I mean, you've really gotten into a groove here in terms of spending the right amount of money, I guess, or getting the right group of people together to make this sound really damn sharp.
I had worked with Scott Evans on another side project of a friend of mine. And Scott comes from this totally different musical background than I do as a recording engineer. He does mostly like heavy music, like metal, hardcore, kind of post-hardcore artsy type stuff. It's noisy and loud and really heavy. And it's been my experience that those guys that are really good at engineering that stuff have phenomenal ears for sound, like organic sounds in room, capturing sounds. You know, it's very performance-oriented. It's not this kind of Beatles-y mentality of like, we're going to construct piece by piece this sound sonic picture. We're going to actually capture musicians playing and create this impression of, you know, liveness, I guess. And that's what I am always really drawn to. not that there aren't production details and layers, but it's all sort of built around this sense that the drums sound like a real drum set and the guitars sound like you're standing right in front of an amplifier. You know, that kind of thing is important to me. And so working with Scott on this side project and seeing how he worked and enjoying his input in his company and recognizing that he also, despite working mostly in this other kind of genre, is a great lover of pop music and has a feel for it and understands it. So it was fun. It was cool to work with a guy who comes from this different background, but whose skills and strengths, I think, really elevated what we were doing and give the album a whole kind of other level of sort of confidence and swagger, maybe, and just impact than we had had on previous recordings.
And any comment about the current new band lineup? I saw you had Casey Bowman. He's got these solo albums. I'm looking at three here. You've got some talent packed in there.
Casey is like a peripheral member. He shows up when he feels like showing up, and he does amazing things. And if he doesn't feel like showing up, it's fine. You know, he doesn't come to practice or whatever. He shows up at shows. He shows up in the studio. He's kind of just brilliant that way. And then we have had another lineup change since the record, even. Charlie Crabtree played drums on most of the record. There's a couple other drummers on a couple of the songs. And since then, actually Joe Becker, who was in the Loud Family and in Thin White Rope, has been our drummer since then. So we're on drummer number, I don't know, 20 or something. I don't know how many drummers we've been through. But the lineup change was a big part of the album, too, because Lenny Gill, who had been our drummer for many, many, many years, switched to lead guitar before the record. So part of the fun of the record, at least for me, was showing off this whole range of fantastic guitar playing that Lenny is capable of that hasn't really been shown on record before.
Well, yeah, the solo in this song. So that's him playing that honky-tonk solo there?
Yeah, and he's, according to him, he's never played a solo like that before, but he can do anything. He's a great guitar player and a great teacher, so he teaches classic rock and whatever students want to learn in his guitar classes. So there's pretty much nothing you can't ask him to do that he won't be able to do well. So part of the fun for me is just saying, hey, Lenny, do this. You know, I know you can do this. Try this. And every time you do that, he comes up with something fantastic. So it's fun.
Nice. Well, I'm so glad to hear that things are continuing to go well and that this project came to fruition.
Yeah, I'm really excited with the response. People have been really excited about it and loving it. And, you know, I think we're already sort of, we're energized, I think, by that response in terms of just thinking about the next thing, kind of keeping pushing forward and building on what we accomplished with this one and how people are liking it.
And then obviously I'm sure that being on this podcast has completely turned your career around, that people are coming up to you on the street.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, every day I get telegrams, you know, telling me about, you know. But no, in all honesty, these things make a big difference in terms of just the energy that surrounds a project. You know, like talking to someone that isn't from your inner circle, that hasn't been necessarily following you for years and years and years, getting their perspective on it, having them share this with their listeners, with a totally different audience. It's not just a marketing tool like, oh yeah, my stuff gets sent around to new ears. It really is just this sort of energy that comes out of talking about creativity, talking about art. It's this great loop that feeds itself. You know, you create something and people are excited about it and you talk about it and it creates more energy to create more, and other songwriters or other listeners hear that and it inspires them to kind of want to dig into something more. So these things are, to me at least, significant. I take them seriously and I really appreciate them because I think of them as part of the energy that surrounds the whole process.
Well, that is a wonderful way to look at it. I think you've had to do just the right amount of press that some of the other guests that I've had on. I got from one guest who was particularly overwhelmed. She told me at the end, well, this did not suck. In other words, like that she's just asked to do so many interviews so often that it's just, it becomes a tremendous chore. And, you know, I've had lots of folks that just will not do an hour long interview, that their lives are too short for that kind of thing. So
I can imagine. I mean, one of the great benefits of being a commercial failure is that you can really, you have more time to focus on things that matter. I can imagine that the really hardcore round of press that people have to do for things must be really exhausting, you know, especially if you're sincere and you really want to do a good job with it, you know. Like, it makes sense to me why you have people who, you know, have blow-ups in an interview or say something completely out of the blue that seems totally incongruous with what you might know about them. It's hard to just kind of talk off the top of your head and you don't know what questions are coming, or you've heard the questions a million times, so you're trying to find a different way to phrase it. I tend to cut people a lot of slack for interviews and try not to hold those as this doctrine of their ideology that has to be consistent, and because interviews are, it's a strange way of thinking. And I guess there are people who are really good at it, but it's a lot of work. So I can imagine that people who have to do a million of them are just really drained by it.
Well, especially if they're susceptible, if they're famous enough and they've gotten into enough trouble that interviewers are prone to ask you. I have not pulled out anything comparable in any of these interviews too. So was this influenced by your arrest for cocaine in the,
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, any media form that has any kind of public juice whatsoever, like, their existence depends upon getting as many clicks and eyes and reads as possible. So if you have developed a reputation for some sort of controversy, that's the first thing they're going to go to. And it just kind of ends up becoming this monster that spins out of control. And it's unfortunate. I mean, it can be entertaining, I suppose, at times, depending on the person. But it's also just like, it's such a strange distortion of the process. You see so many interviews where the interviewer isn't going into the interview with sort of a personal exploration of the work. They're going into it like, how do I get to these flashpoints so that I can make this person talk about this thing that I want them to talk about, so I can have something, you know, quotable. And then the whole conversation is no longer a conversation at that point. And that's unfortunate, but that's their job, I guess, to a certain extent.
I just do that through episode titles. So it'll be Bradley Bears It All. Exactly. Tells you the secret of...
You won't believe... ...
All right, well, have a wonderful holiday season. Thanks so much for talking to me again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and you too. Take care.
Mr. Jeff Heiskell, it's Mark Linton.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Well, I'm very excited to talk to you again about your new album, Emotional Terrorism. Congrats on getting... So October, that just came out?
Yes.
And I was trying to figure out, sort of listening to the whole thing, is comparing to Arriving, and I couldn't figure out a simple way to characterize the progression in style. I mean, it sort of seems like more of the same, but there was a lot of variation on the last album. There's a lot of variation on this album. You've got some very fast, fun songs. You've got some slightly, like, the closing track is pretty epic. You've got some very emotionally charged stuff going on here. Can you say anything about overall the direction that's been happening in these last 2 years that got you to this?
Well, I just do what I do, which is I've basically come from the folky singer-songwritery camp, if you trace back when I started making music. So I just write songs, and they kind of are what's going on in my life at the moment, usually. I'm easily bored, so I can't really write the same type of song, two songs in a row. And then there's the one song, I Want More Life. I had that lyric kind of floating around for years. It's taken from the first Blade Runner movie. And I bought this little keyboard for $32 at Bargain Hut. And then I just sat down and wrote that really in an hour on that. And it's interesting that when I came back to it, it's a good thing I got it on my phone, because when I came back to it, the keyboard had died. I only got one song out of it. It is a little bit thematic. I think, you know, there's a lot of abandonment, isolation, ongoing intimacy issues. But like I said, I just read, well, that whiskey lick, somebody had used that term when we were riding down the road and there was a dent in the car. And I had never heard whiskey lick. Have you heard that before?
No, I had not heard that particular phrase.
If somebody's got a beat up hole, like their car's all beat up on one side, you call a dent like that, you call it a whiskey lick, and then like they were drinking. And he said, you need to write a song called Whiskey Lick. And I was like, yeah. And then some months passed, and I got tired of working on my property and went over there and spent two exhausting days clearing the property around John's studio by hand, me and my caffeine problem. And for doing that, we were over there recording something else, and he had been on one of his travels and gave me a really nice bottle of red wine. I don't drink red wine. I drink white. And basically, the studio is 3 miles from my house. We had been drinking a little beer, but I basically wrote that song in my head from the studio to back to my house and was able to find the chords in my head on the guitar. So again, and I was having a little bit of a relationship issue with somebody. So all that just kind of came together. And that's how that song was written.
Yeah, and you picked those two nice outliers there. I had been wondering about that very thin keyboard sound, and Whiskey Lick is definitely the most fun one. Let's move to Still Life with Broken Heart, the one that we're actually going to hear. This is a little more conservative for you in that it has that yearning that is common to a lot of your songs. I think this is a pretty especially effective one. And so this is the same production team as the last album. You know, it's got a nice warm, has the little goofy portamento synth thing going over it, but basically guitar
based with a lot of focus on the vocal harmonies and the vocal harmony effects, you know, that you're kind of singing in different tones against yourself and even some digital manipulation of some of the backing vocal here.
John said, we didn't get the rock song. I was like, oh, okay. So that's what I did. I went home the next day and started working on that and got that done in a couple of days. And it's kind of purposefully thick and early 90s-like. And I think that also led to, you know, using the synth on things is something that I really, synthesizers, I had a lot of fun on this track and the other tracks. But I had written that song on acoustic. Those lyrics were something I had worked on acoustic guitar, and I didn't like it. There was something syrupy about it. And so I completely blanked that out, and I started playing that guitar riff, and I really don't sing like that. I don't know where that came from. The verse, I don't sing like that usually. So the fact that lyric was so good, I was like, well, surely someone has written a song called Still Life with Broken Heart, or there's a book or something, and I can't just come up with that. And so I Googled it, and nobody had there was nothing there with Still Life with Broken Heart. I'm like, really? That's really good. We did that breakdown when I say Still Life, you know, using, I had a helium tank.
Actually, this is not digital. It's helium in the
no,
studio.
No, that's not digital. I was like, I'm bringing my helium tank over today. John's like, why? I said, well, I want to use it on Still Life. He was like, John Pesci goes, okay.
again, it seems like this is a pretty spontaneous arrangement in terms of not a lot of overthinking how these vocals are going to layer, other than you had the foresight to bring the helium tank.
The whole concept of this collection of songs, everything is organic. Everything is spontaneous. None of these songs were ever practiced, ever. You show up, you've heard some bad little rendition that John and I have done with a click track, and you learn the song and you put down your part and that's it and it's done. That's where everything's done. And same thing with the background vocals. I don't really have a whole lot of plans for those. We just get over there and I start humming and John gives me direction and a lot of times takes me places that he makes these high-pitched squeals and like, but you probably can't sing that high, which, you know, I love a challenge and I'm like, yeah, I will sing that high even if it makes me pass out. So there's no rehearsals with this group of people. Everybody's so talented. We just get together and put it down.
And this main riff, which sounds very kind of Sonic Youth, I don't know, you know, not normal chords. Is this, again, kind of you just putting your fingers on the guitar until something sounds cool? This is an open string kind of thing?
Exactly. I have no idea what chords I'm playing, and I still refuse to learn what chords I'm playing. In fact, they talk about, these people teach guitar. You know, they know theory and stuff. And I go over there to show them songs. It happened. I got a new song. And the very first chord I played, John just like frowned. And I played it again. He looks at it. He goes, oh, God. He goes, what is it? That's another high school chord. What is that? Oh, you crack me up. I'm like, they should know every chord in the history of chordism. And I'm constantly, but yeah, that song definitely had a couple of chords in it. They were like, what in the hell are you doing there? Do that again. That's a high school chord. I'm intuitive on the guitar. That's how I play. I just sit there until I come up with something that I really like. Some of the odd chords that I find, you know, I'm very fascinated by those, and that's usually how a song starts. I find a chord that I just really like the way it sounds and go from there.
In the chorus, just, I mean, the frozen in the moment, that one line, I don't know, it could be kind of a 90s alternative rock thing, but just the fact that it happens, it's kind of a big production, and it happens three times. You know, it makes it feel frozen in the moment that you're repeating this thing, gesture, that's kind of a little too long that you would sort of think of that it's the kind of thing that you just repeat three times, you know, like that, so that it really then gives you a place to build when you have everything drop out and speak the last line. It's strangely effective.
There's a little bit of psychology behind it. You know, like I said, the background vocals, that was just come up. But I'm really drawn a lot of times to repetition in music and in art. So I think some of that bled over into a lot of these songs. I'm all about doing things in threes instead of fours. I have I'm going to record, put down vocals for a new song. So I'm very into threes instead of twos and fours. And then there's that All Shards and Light thing in the middle.
Which is a whole different song. It's like a Queen song, or I wrote operatic next to it. It's a crazy bridge.
I said, now, Gray Comer's engineer, and he also plays guitar and, well, a lot of other things on there, piano, other things. I said, now, Gray, I said, I'm getting ready to do something here. I'm going to be cracking up while I'm doing it. I want to get very operatic with this. He goes, okay. So I started putting those down. He goes, oh, my God. And I said, and I want three-part harmony. It was hard to sing it because I was laughing the whole time because I don't ever sing like that. He goes, God, this is so art fag. What are we doing? And then so that's a lot of the way we work. So, yeah, that whenever that comes up, it completely, in the song, it still cracks me up because it's just complete, like you're saying, it's very Queen. It's completely over the top.
And then the one really punctuating thing, just this clapping, this intro. I mean, was this something added at the end, or was this, again, part of the premise of at least your reworking of the song?
No, I had left that empty. And they were like, when we were first tracking the song, like, well, what are we going to be doing here? And I gave Jason some direction on the drums during that part. But I had kind of thought in my head that I was going to do clapping there the whole time, but I didn't say anything about it. I didn't know what we were going to do with those empty spaces. I just knew that I wanted to start that way. And then we were way into the song. I said, well, what are we doing today? I said, we're adding hand claps. John Gray said, we are. Where? I said, well, let me show you. And they're like, oh. So we did three different tracks. There's a three of us clapping. We did three different tracks.
Just looking at the lyrics, there really aren't that many lyrics because you've got the repetition. It's almost like titles of paintings here.
And the whole time that I was writing the song, I saw there being a video for it. you know, I did a video for I Want More Life, and the video for this, for Still Life, is done as of 2 days ago. And I got some fabric and stuff and a table, and I built a set in my garage. The background singers are hand puppets that I had somebody make for me. So they're sock puppets. And I brought some things from work, and I spent $40 on fruit. But anyway, I made a beautiful still life on this table, and my head is in a platter.
Singing from the platter. Nice.
I am part of the still life. And then the other part of the video is me out. It's a birding, Seven Islands Birding Center, and there's an old house out there. But I'm dressed up in one of my velvet outfits with wearing a massive amount of makeup. It gets a little Charlie Chaplin. But there's actually, I'm being followed by myself. Actually, by two of myself are following me out there on the road and through the house. And it's a little Pee Wee's Playhouse. It's a little bit Saturday morning cartoons gone a little bit acid trippy. That's kind of what the video looks like.
Well, I guess combining self-doubt, barely gifted, compromised, honorable mention, curated lie, you know, Charles Schulz established, we can mix self-loathing with a cartoon-like imagery.
We can be stuck in one or two of Eric Erickson's developmental phases for our entire life, and it can still be kind of funny.
Well, very nice. I can't wait to see the video. I will link folks to it.
I'm going to put it up on Christmas Day.
Wonderful. It'll be, yeah, it'll definitely be up. All right. So I'll link folks to that. Yeah. Thanks so much for checking in with us. So you're already working on the next album now?
I have a song. I actually have Matt Honkanen from a really talented group here in town, Peak Physique. Matt is actually rapping on the new tune that I've finished.
That's new.
It has a drum loop in the background. It has no real drums on it. It's very Spartan. And then I'm going to put the other song is, it's punk rock. It's what it is. I look at all these muscle queers in the morning before I go to the gym on Instagram, and there's one guy that looks like a cartoon. His name is Alexander Bear 69. So I've written a song, a punk rock song called Alexander Bear 69. And they put the guitars and stuff down the other night, and it sounds awesome. So, yeah, I'm two songs deep into it, and I was kind of working on another song last night. So, always doing something.
Well, very nice. I'm glad to hear it with the, not the 2 years between the last two albums is long or anything, but it had been quite a long time before that one. And so the fact that you're back in a very steady groove, it sounds like.
I'm in a really good place now. Like you know, the 2 year of getting the last one together. And then one of the reasons Emotional Terrorism sounds so good is I did not get in a hurry at all about anything. And I didn't think at all about the expense, the studio time expense. We spent the required amount of time that was needed for every song, regardless of how many times we might have to come back to it to get it where we want it. And same thing with this, whatever comes up next, whether I do a whole CD or I do a 5-song release, I don't know. Just taking my time.
Yeah, that seems to be the movement. Several folks I've talked to recently like are just, I don't want to wait even a year to, you need to keep people on the hook. Just release them as they're done. You can always package them together later, but you know, put some singles out, put some EPs, something to keep it coming.
I wouldn't be surprised this time if I don't do maybe even a 3-song EP and then go on and do another 3-song. We'll just see how things develop.
All right. Well, thanks for checking in. So good to talk to you again.
All righty. Thanks a lot.
Hello, Steve Petrinko.
Hi, Mark Linsenmeyer.
Thank you for joining me for the year-end extravaganza.
I'm very happy to be here.
You have, since we talked, wow, a year and a half ago, more than that, come out with a tribute to the Bee Gees, 66 through 78.
Yes, I have.
Which you had been working on at the time. We talked about your Elvis covers album. This is unusual for this podcast in that, you know, we focus on original music, but I found in talking to you about the Elvis stuff and talking to some of the other folks that have done cover songs, just as much creative juice goes into doing the particular arrangements. It's a different kind of thing, obviously, but it's still a deeply personal creative project, right?
Oh, for sure. In fact, I spent a lot more time doing this project than I did on any of mine for my own music. There's so many tracks. The Bee Gees were just, they had so many people in the studio at one time and cut everything live with the giant band. And so to be able to come close to replicating that type of awesomeness, I mean, it really takes a lot of thought and a lot of time.
And why the focus, you say, 66 through 78, actually most of these songs are from, you know, 75, 76, and then there's a couple outliers from earlier. So you could have just said a tribute to the Bee Gees, but it's not, you know, you're not trying to systematically, it's not like one track from every album through that period or something. What was the thought in the selection?
The thought process was that I was going to do an album that had some earlier songs through half of the disco era and then do a second album. So I didn't end up having a 25-song album because it's impossible for me to pick which songs I want to do, that I would have two albums. And this way I could have the songs that people would want and some songs that they hadn't heard before, and then have a second album that would also have songs that they would want and also songs they hadn't heard before. So I planned to do a 78 to 2017 album that way also. So I left some stuff off on purpose, like Tragedy, and even though the Bee Gees didn't record it for themselves, but like Emotion from Samantha Sang. I left those things off on purpose so that I'd be able to have a second album and have people still want to listen to it.
Yes, you have Night Fever, Staying Alive, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, Nights on Broadway, Jive Talking, big things like that, but then you Should Be Dancing. But then also some of these lesser tunes. I hadn't heard Morning of My Life. That seems like the oldest tune on here that you open the whole thing with. And the one we're going to talk about here, Wind of Change, I'd actually never listened to this entire main course album, 1975. You know, it's got a couple, leads off with a couple of the singles, Nights on Broadway. But this one, I guess there's some subtle social commentary in something like Staying Alive. Like it's kind of talking about how gritty it is out in the city and stuff. But Winds of Change is a more straightforward kind of like what's going on. Wind of Change, I should say. Tell us a little before we play it, sort of what that song meant to you, what your approach in covering it was.
Quite honestly, when I started to do the Bee Gees project, I had some falsetto notes missing at the top of my range that I had when I was a younger man. And so I started to pick songs that didn't have high G's above the bar in the soprano range because I couldn't do it. But eventually, after singing this stuff for a year and a half before even attempting the vocal parts, all that range came back. So I did the song because I liked it and because it was in my range. It didn't have anything too crazy in it. I just really like what it sounded like. I've never been a lyrics kind of person, so I didn't really study the lyrics that much exactly, but I love the way all of it fit together, and I like the way that Barry had sung that song. It doesn't sing every song the same. He's got a number of different vocal styles that he uses, and this one I like to think that he uses the style that he used on Andy Gibbs' Shadow Dancing for the background vocals. It's a very different sound for him versus some of his other wispier, almost tremolo type things that he would do. This was, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It really is. It's his shadow dancing voice, and I loved it, and I wanted a song that was like that.
Get on up.
Yeah, so we've got a couple different vocal styles in here. We got the little whispery thing where the lyrics don't even jump out necessarily. And then the full-on in the chorus thing, which you're double-tracking everything here, right?
Oh, it's a lot more than double-tracking. So to get that Bee Gees sound, I mean, they did a lot of studio work. They're very detail-oriented. So I don't know how many Barry Gibbs there actually is on the original recording, but on mine, just for the lead vocal track, there's six individually recorded tracks of the same part. So there's two parts are panned left, right, all the way. Two parts are panned 50% left, right. And then there's two parts in the center, which really created a fun effect. I hadn't planned to use all six. I just recorded six of them because I figured I'd go through them and find the ones that sounded the best and use whichever, and maybe use two or three. But it really sounded great with the six. And there's just a lot of little jump out bits that come in the stereo spectrum recording that way. So there's six for the melody, and then there's four background vocal tracks. Sometimes for a given harmony, there's four of the same harmony at the same time, and then sometimes it splits into two of like a third and two of like a fifth. But with the Bee Gees, it's never the third and the fifth. It's like the sixth and the ninth or something like that. It's almost never the third and the fifth. Doesn't happen.
Now, it sounded like you followed pretty closely the arrangement of the original, that it wasn't just, I've listened to this song a lot, I've sung it on my own, and I'm kind of going to do my own version. It sounds like that you are aiming for not exactly a sound-alike sound, but something pretty darn, something that has the same, accounts for the same gesture. So like, you're not going to have the same sound. I wish there's a term, maybe there is. So you've got these synth noises that they crescendo, but then they also, the tone opens up. Like, is there a term like crescendo, but that's referring to its change in the tone becoming sharper as opposed to the getting louder?
I call that frequency sweep.
The frequency sweep. There you go.
Yeah.
You know, you on your keyboard are not going to have the same frequency sweep gesture that they use, but like, there is that there. It's just, it might be mixed slightly differently. I thought, you know, I noticed when I was listening to the original, there were very audible congas. And I was like, okay, I guess Steve didn't do that. But then I'm listening closely to yours. It sounds like actually the congas are in yours. It's just that they're more buried, that it's just, it gives it an overall more modern digital feel.
A lot of my mixing decisions are based on whether something's going to stick out horrible or not. And to record, I don't know how many tracks, let's say 30 different tracks of me over myself, there's going to be some peaks that aren't going to hit exactly right. And so if I buried the conga, it was to just not have anything stick out too much. But it's definitely there, and I did play all the way through. But if I thought it was going to deter from the song, then I pushed it farther back in the mix.
And then we've got this gesture, this bow, 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 that's used in so many songs. It's like the Funky Town, that gesture, which, and when you bring it up at the end, where everything sort of breaks and that comes in, like on your version, it's quite a bit more prominent. Like I barely even noticed it on the original. Like, yeah, it happens, but it's not like this, like it sounded like you added an extra layer of stuff. Is that when you're doing it normally in the song, like at the beginning, is that keyboard with a frequency sweep on it, with a phaser on it, or is it guitar?
So there's almost virtually no guitar on this particular song. There's guitar at the breakdown in the middle going into the end.
Okay.
But the rest of it is clavinet. Bee Gees used a lot of clavinet. They actually didn't use a lot of electric guitar. Clavinet's pretty close to electric guitar. It's actually strings. It's like a Rhodes without the metal tines. It's got strings on the inside of it. And it's commonly used with a wah-wah. So I played the clavinet part with the wah-wah, kind of Stevie Wonder type of thing. And when I do one of these type of songs where I'm paying homage, in a way where I know everything that's going on in that song. And there was something that when you and I used to work together that you would call sub-audible things that would be in the background that only you would hear because you were that kind of fan, that you would hear everything they did, and that those things that were small were just as important to you as the things that were on top. And one of my goals was to hear everything that happened in the recording and bring those things a little farther forward so that you can hear them. And other people have listened to my record have said that that's how they heard it too, that they were just like, oh, I never heard any of those things before until I heard your record. And then I'd listen to the old record and then I could hear them. They were in the background, but I never noticed them before. So I liked it so much that I wanted to bring those things out so that people could hear what was actually there. Obviously, I didn't play everything exactly the same, and I took some liberties, and especially with the clavinet part, I just like playing clavinet, so I probably play 300 or 400% more notes than they did with the clavinet part, but it's fun for me.
Well, and your sax style is totally different too. I know this has been, you know, one of the great musical adventures of your adult life is learning to play sax as your son has been learning. And it doesn't, like the version that's on there, I mean, they're both kind of reverb drenched, but your playing has much more of that pure sax tone. Whereas on the recording, even though it's, you know, it's the same kind of very short solo, it's the same places where it comes in, but it's got more of that David Sanborn-y kind of grit. Was that just a conscious choice, or is that just because you don't play that kind of grit at this point? I'm not even sure what constitutes the grit. Is it just pushing really hard through it? Like what makes that, that sax sound?
Part of the grit is actually using like a Spanish roll with your tongue so you can over it.
Oh, yeah.
And that'll bring some of that out. The biggest part of it is the mouthpiece opening. And when I had recorded this song, all I had was a classical mouthpiece. So the classical mouthpiece is going to give you a more kind of a sine wave kind of tone. And if you get a jazz mouthpiece, it has a bigger opening, the harder to play. I have one now. That will give you more of that sound with the bite in it. Also, just to be able to play their sax players playing, I need a few more years on me to be able to get to that. But I was real proud of my part. It's in tune and
no, it's bright and beautiful.
Yeah, so it's a little different than theirs, but.
And then the string hits are pretty much right on. What establishes the sonic tone of the song for a lot of it is this kind of what you choose to use as the extended, as the pad, so that you've got this synth tone that's, it's not going to sound like a string quartet playing. Say a little about kind of how you were made the choice to fill that section? Were you just trying to get as close to the original sound as you could get, given your equipment?
So for me, I understand what the Bee Gees orchestra is, and I went and I searched for ways to recreate the Bee Gees orchestra. And part of their sound is to literally have full strings available to them, but they also used something called a Solinas string machine. I actually have a Solinas string machine. I didn't use that. I ended up using samples. So there's a company called Native Instruments, and they have some samples available there called Session Pro Strings, Session Pro, something like that. It's made for disco. They sampled real strings as if you were going to use it in a disco setting. So it was like it was handmade for me. And I had found that, and I decided to use that. And then the same company also had horns that worked out too, Session Pro horns, Session Pro strings, that's what they're called. I just used both of those sounds because that's what the Bee Gees did. They have their horn section, and they have, like I said, I think they use the string machine on there, not real strings, but I like the one that had the tremolo strings going a little bit better. My strings are a little bit more agitated than theirs are, but for whatever reason, even their agitation that they had in the strings was like at the exact right tempo I needed for this song. So I think it was just fate.
And then the last minute of the song, so as you said, you come back in with the, I'll call it the long train running riff, the bow, but out, which at that point is keys and guitar. You said you actually threw guitar on top of that. So it's a little different, jumps out a little more than previously. And then just the whole rest of the song on your version sounds more like a kind of psychedelic freak out to me, maybe just because of those super challenging vocal things that just hearing anybody else do them, like it's not just like a little sweep up. It's like it's a big power.
The giant falsetto at the end, I don't remember if it's F sharp or it's G, but I had to like step like 8 feet away from the microphone, and like I would do it and it would over, I never thought it would even be possible. I would overload the input into the computer and the computer would stop running because it's like, oh, you're going to fry something, because it was that loud to scream those things up in there. So it's, yeah, it's not effects or anything like that. I mean, there are six of them, but that's V. That's V at the, you know, just body cavity. That's my natural resonant frequency for F sharp or G or whatever it is.
Did you choose to do that when nobody else was home? That an hour and a half of the screaming?
Oh my God. My children and my wife know the Bee Gees catalog far too well. They know all of the parts.
Okay. I recall what I was doing some, you know, when we lived together in the small apartment, and I was doing some kind of punch in thing, and it was just like poem, poem, poem. And I like was recording this for like 20 minutes, and you were going to beat on me because so I could see doing this. Like I need to do this same screaming crescendoing thing, not only like the six times it takes to get the level right, but then I'm recording it six separate times, and some of those are not all going to be, you know, so that must have been at least a half hour of people having to hear this one thing.
Oh, it totally was. And it ended up being several days too, because like I said, it kept on cutting out and stopping my recording. So I did the first 10 takes or whatever, and I had the giant big vibrato on it, and I was all happy with it, and it was cutting out. And then like by the time that I got to doing ones that actually took, I couldn't do it with the vibrato anymore, so I had to do it the next day. So they got to hear it twice. Sorry, Shelly. Sorry, kids. What are you going to do?
Well, all right. Well, any other sort of general comments on how this song and your interpretation of this fits in with the rest of what you did? It seems like they were all kind of similarly faithful. They're different levels of disco. Some of them are, I think Boogie Child is the only one that's like really kind of over the top in your face disco. Like even Jive Talkin' is a little, I don't know. Would it have, before I was into disco, made me cringe? I'm not sure if that's the right measure or something, but like even Boogie Child is like almost more of a early 70s funk thing, like this one, like the Long Train Running riff, than what you associate with Saturday Night Fever.
I think that the Bee Gees would agree with that too. The Bee Gees had always said, you know, they have a couple songs that you could possibly classify as pure disco, but they're kind of an R&B band, and they weren't doing anything too different than, yeah, I mean, not as out of the ordinary as some of the funk bands that were around at the time, but they were an R&B funk band for the most part, and they got kind of pushed into a category that they only dabbled in unfairly. I mean, obviously, they made the three largest or four largest disco songs that ever existed and had an album stayed on the charts forever and ever and defined the era. but it's such a small part of their catalog and what they did that they actually got kind of hurt by it, that there was anti-disco and all of that. But I think that's under the bridge now. I think people in general like it. So I guess the only other thing that I want to say is that at the end of the song, that I had brought forward background vocals that are just hinted at in the song, and that I came a little full circle with that, and that there's an Elvis technique that I had used. It's almost Elvis's Sweet Sensations background vocalists at the end, and that I liked putting the Elvis bit in there because I know that the Bee Gees were influenced by Elvis, as was everyone.
You definitely inspired me here since I've been listening to your album to... I still haven't completed my going back through the old Bee Gees catalog, but like, you know, I'd had a 3-disc greatest hits through their, you know, so I looked a little bit at the progression and from the 60s to the 70s stuff, but never really, I still don't have it very clear in my mind, like how a basically neo Beatles, Monkees, Beatles light kind of band that they started out as when they were really young in 66 or so, you know, how they morphed gradually into this, the thing that we know from the late 70s. And so getting some of these pieces filled in with the mid 70s, slightly early 70s, I was just, you know, listening to the main course album, then the two albums before that, just since yesterday. I'm filling in that picture a little bit. It does make it more relatable in that, you know, these were not just dance punks or I don't know what the term. They didn't start with the disco sound, certainly. Like, they were just into eclectic, melodic, pretty songs in the same way. Yeah. So you get McCartney songs from this era, you know, also having disco beat. You have Stone. So like it's not that they were unique in feeling like, hey, we should actually pay attention to black music and we should try to make something that has a groove to it. Like, that's a fairly natural progression, at least one of the ways to progress from like what the Beatles were doing, even though that's not sort of how rock and roll history would maybe spell it out for you.
I think part of what happened is that in 1975, you end up with, 74, you end up with a new producer, you end up with a new drummer, you end up with a new keyboard player, you end up with a new guitar player. That's what the band sounded like at that time. And in the 60s, people don't give the Bee Gees credit as being a band, but they really were a band in the 60s, and they had dedicated musicians, and they had a sound with that band. And then when the new band came, they had a different sound. So in the 60s, they really did parallel the Beatles completely. I mean, Barry Gibb is John Lennon. That's his persona in the band. And Robin Gibb is Paul McCartney. And they even have those vocal qualities. And Morris Gibb is George Harrison. I mean, he actually even does the George Harrison accent and rolling the R's and things sometimes to be funny, and has that type of humor that George injected into the music, even though, you know, people said he was the dark Beatle or the quiet Beatle or the whatever. He was the funny Beatle. He was really funny. And so you get that interaction. You also get those three different vocal sounds, which created that what the Beatles were. I mean, McCartney by himself is just McCartney. All three of them together is magic, and that's what Barry always says, too. If you have one of us, we're pretty good. If you got two of us, that's great. And then if you have three of us, then that's magic. And the magic comes in the differences in their vocal styles. And I actually tried to do that when I was recording. So I learned how to sing like Barry Gibb in the different ways that Barry Gibb sings. I tried to sing like Morris Gibb and Robin Gibb. I learned each one of their ways of singing and what they do. And especially when they would come together and you would get the sound that is the Bee Gees, the thing that makes your skin break out in goose flesh. And you're just like, oh, what is that? It's that combination of those three different kind of vocal sounds at one time that creates the magic. I really tried my hardest to do that.
Well, thanks so much for sharing this. Any other news you want to share of what's the next project?
I got three kind of going one time. I got a sorbet that I'm doing right now. So I'm doing a She's a Rainbow by the Rolling Stones. That's about 2/3 of the way done. I have a jazz project that I'm doing with my saxophone teacher. I won't be playing saxophone on it because he's a doctorate of saxophone. And, well, there's no reason for me to play saxophone on it. In any case, we'll be doing some smooth jazz covers that way. I hope to be doing some originals soon. And simultaneously, I'm going to be working on this second Bee Gees album, but the second Bee Gees album, I think I'm going to put out a song at a time on YouTube. And when it's done, then I'll put out a compilation on CD Baby. But I don't want to wait a year or a year and a half or 2 years anymore to put something out. I want the instant gratification. When it's done, it's going to be put out. And then it's a lot happier, better for me. It's more fun that way. So probably early 2018, Tragedy is on deck.
All right. Well, thanks for participating.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I love what you do. Thank you for doing this program. I know it means a lot to you. I know you've gotten to meet a lot of your heroes, and I think what you're doing is a wonderful thing. It's wonderful for those artists, and it's wonderful for you. It's wonderful for listeners to hear this type of in-depth discussion. It's a fantastic format. I appreciate it.
My name is Tyler Hislop, musician and sound engineer for the podcast. As we bring the year into a close, I've had a pretty intimate relationship with Nakedly Examined Music. I've learned quite a lot about the podcasting process, what goes into the audio and engineering. I've had to push myself to try to keep the audio as consistent across episodes as possible, with some errors, unfortunately, along the way. What has made this project amazing is following Mark's passion for deep understanding, whether it be with music or with philosophy, from the famous to the unknown. NEM unearths the work and creativity that musicians put into their music. The song I'm going to leave you with is our response to Blade Runner, in a way, but more so a dive into the existential, confronting social imposition writ large. I constructed a strange synthy beat and wrote some rhymes. Mark sent me the awesome vocals that you hear in the chorus, and here you have it. Happy New Year, everyone.
On a 30-minute delay, and the pixel boxes in the shop. They'll tinker until they think it's fixed or not. You'll find out when you switch it on and feel the shock or not. This situation's a strange one. An existential bullet in a strange gun. You'll cock it and aim once. So what? This situation's a strange one. An existential bullet in a strange gun. So what? So what? Don't fire for souls caught in the matrix. Don't fire for hope, all of it's tainted. So dire, the saints would hold fire. Keep your bullet in the chamber, you're so tired. With not enough reserves to go around, slow it down. You're not as tough as you first had hoped, and now you're feeding an automaton. Deuce X, the truth is your mind is gone. A sign of longevity lost a strong enemy they call entropy. You're feeding silicone and transistors. That's not what I call empathy. My hand quivers, so I hold the nose down to land quicker. The situation's a strange one. An existential bullet in a strange gun. You'll cock it and aim once. The situation's a strange one. An existential bullet in a strange gun. You'll cock it and aim once. So what? You'll cock it and aim once. So what? So what?
Our wounds and nihilism. Our wounds inside will stop. Our wounds and nihilism. Our wounds inside will stop. I'll lose my illusion. I'll lose the sun. Stop inside.